could be fatal. Repeating, a bulletin from CBS News, President Kennedy has been shot by a would-be assassin in Dallas, Texas. Stay tuned to CBS News for further details.
I knew I had been hit. 30 years after the Kennedy assassination, John Connolly recalls in his autobiography the moment that changed his life and the world. By Mickey Herskovitz. Published October 1993. I heard what I thought was a rifle shot. I turned my head in the direction of the sound, which seemed to come from behind my right shoulder. My eyes saw nothing unusual, but I felt an icy chill of anxiety. I turned to the left, toward President and Mrs. Kennedy. In the middle of my turn, I felt a thud, as if someone had pounded me on the back with a fist, a blow so hard I doubled over. My eyes were still open. I could see blood drenching my shirt, and I knew I had been hit. The car jerked into another speed. My wife, Nellie, pulled me to her lap and said without panic, "Be still." I blurted out the words, "My God, they are going to kill us all." In a microsecond it took for that cry to leap from my lips, two things happened. Nellie's action saved my life, and the conspiracy theorists had the first peg on which to hang their endless webs of intrigue. John Connolly, the governor of Texas, had referred to the collective they, the mysterious they, the ever-present and all-powerful they. It would be a conceit to think, much less claim, that a spontaneous outburst from a wounded man touched off the cycle of conspiracy plots that have spread like crabgrass and whose numbers continue to grow with each passing November. If my phrasing encouraged anyone, and apparently it did, I resent and deplore being used in any way to turn the tragedy into a cottage industry. I suppose the conspiracy rumors began that day, the first of the books, within months or weeks. We have had the two Oswalds, the two guns, the two John Kennedys, conspiracies sponsored by the Soviets, by Fidel Castro, by the Mafia, the FBI, the CIA, and the oil cartel. Anyone with a theory could find an audience or a forum. The wackier the theory, the stronger the response. At least one book, probably more, argued that Lee Harvey Oswald was a Russian spy. I believe you could make a better case that his wife, Marina, was the lost princess Anastasia. Of course, none of this was on my mind as our motorcade, traveling on Main Street, approached Dealey Plaza. On the northwest corner was the Texas School Book Depository, an ugly brick building, once a dull red, but now sandblasted to a shade of rust. In 1901, it had been erected as the offices of the Southern Rock Island Plow Company. It looked like a factory. I had driven past that spot many times. It was just another roadway whose only purpose was to move you along to a prettier section of town. That day, it would join Ford's Theater in the history of the nation. The fact that it did will be a source of pain to me all my life, both for the tragic act that happened there and for the shadow it cast on Texas so unfairly. The day was brilliant and sunny and crisp, and the president had made the decision not to use the bulletproof top that came with the car. We were all smiling and waving to the crowds. I was, frankly, relieved, pleased with how lovely the day had turned out, and by the size and enthusiasm of the crowds that lined the curbs. Then I heard the first shot, and I felt the second. Both the sound and the impact like a loud smack. In such a moment of helplessness, of total alarm and confusion, your mind races. You have perhaps a fragment of rational thought left before the pain or the fear or both take over. And I knew with a terrible certainty that all of us were players in a major tragedy. A third shot was fired, and the president's brain tissue and blood were splattered over the blue velour of the limousine, over Nellie's clothes and my own. By then, my head was resting in my wife's lap, and she was whispering to me, "Be still. You're going to be all right." From a distance, as if in an echo chamber, I heard Jackie Kennedy cry out, "I have his brains in my hands." As I was losing consciousness, I heard one more voice, a Secret Service agent screaming at the driver, "Get out of line. Get us to a hospital quick." I was vaguely aware of the motion of the car jerking into high speed, pulling away from the rest of the motorcade. I may have heard the sirens. I can't be sure. I felt frozen, and my ears rang with the echo of the gunshots or the sirens of the police or an inward wail that said Jack Kennedy was dead. Of that I was sure. And I was dying. Lee Harvey's legacy. Rachel Oswald did not kill John F. Kennedy, but for more than three decades, she has struggled to make peace with the darkest day in Texas history. By Keith Kachtick, published March 1995. The Texas Chili Parlor is a neighborhood bar without a neighborhood, stuck in the no man's land between the state capitol and the University of Texas campus. The Chili Parlor is so steeped in Austin tradition that its decision several years ago to begin offering chili with beans got coverage on the local TV news. The bar's decor consists chiefly of scuffed wooden tables and junkyard scraps nailed to the walls, rusted license plates, cow skulls, yellowed newspaper clippings, and a hand-scrawled sign above the cash register noting that tipping is not a city in China. Old Life magazine photographs used to hang on the walls, including one of Jack Ruby shooting Lee Harvey Oswald. "I don't think anybody I worked with ever thought twice about it," Rachel Oswald said. "You see that image everywhere. It's easy to take it for granted." But it was still depressing, seeing my father shot every time I came to work. For 7 years, Rachel was a waitress at the Chili Parlor while she put herself through nursing school. One night, at the end of her shift, she and I shared a bowl of queso, chips, and $2 Bloody Marys. I asked Rachel how many people in the bar knew who she was. "Who I am?" she asked. "Or who my father was?" I nodded that I appreciated that distinction. "The people I've worked with the longest know. A few of the regulars." The late night air had become a distinctive Texas medley of cigarette smoke and day-old chili fumes. Stevie Ray Vaughan was turned up loud on the radio. In a bar filled with pretty women, Rachel was striking enough to turn heads. She wore a purple dress from a vintage clothing store, platform shoes, and a black string choker. Even at 29, she had a tomboyish quality, and when she laughed, she seemed to be all elbows and collarbones. In conversation, Rachel could be both reserved and outgoing, and though she speaks with a slow drawl, her dark eyes, high cheeks, and thick, heavy eyebrows make it clear she is of Slavic descent. She looks a bit like Helena Bonham Carter, who coincidentally played her mother Marina in a 1993 TV movie about the Oswald family. It is difficult to imagine what life must be like for the child of a celebrity, having a recognizable last name, a childhood in the spotlight. But imagine the life of a child fathered by a villain. A child cursed with a name like Booth or Oswald. Especially Oswald. Even now, 3 decades after President Kennedy's death, the name still stirs up strong emotions, particularly in Texas. To much of the world, Texas is Dallas, the place where JFK was shot. Most Texans resent this with a passion, and many of them blame Rachel's father. You know, it's interesting if you think about it, Rachel said, lighting a cigarette. Probably the only other people in America who have to routinely see film images of their father being killed are the children of President Kennedy. She blew a long stream of smoke toward the ceiling. Kind of strange, huh? Audrey Marina Rachel Oswald was 33 days old when President Kennedy was killed. 35 days old when Jack Ruby killed her father. She was born in Dallas's Parkland Memorial Hospital, the same hospital where both Kennedy and her father were transported after being shot. Rachel's mother, Marina, then barely in her 20s, had arrived from Minsk, Russia, only a year earlier, and spoke very little English. According to Rachel, in the months immediately after Lee's murder, Marina, Rachel, and her 2-year-old sister survived chiefly on the charity of churches in the Dallas suburb of Richardson. I asked what it was like being named Oswald and growing up so close to Dallas. Rachel thought for a moment. I didn't know my family was any different until I was about 7. One day, my mother sat my sister and me down on our big green couch and told me that the man who had raised us as our father, our stepfather Kenneth, was not, you know, our real father, and that our real father's name was Lee Oswald, and that he had, well, that he had been accused of killing the President of the United States. Rachel smiled. This helped explain why our school bus was sometimes followed by news teams, why our mailbox got shot at, why kids at school would ask, "Did your daddy shoot the president?" At home, we rarely discussed Lee. We were just trying to be a normal family. Every once in a while, my mother would say that I looked like him, that I ate like him, that my legs looked like his legs. But for the most part, we just didn't talk about it. I asked her what else she remembered about growing up. I remember that my mother was very beautiful, that she had been written up in Life magazine. When we moved to Rockwall, which was much smaller than Richardson, people there lived on farming and football. Everyone in town knew my mother. She was this delicate Russian beauty, widowed by a man who shot the president. We were of interest to people. For the most part, folks were nice, but they were always whispering things. I remember that helicopters flew over my mother's wedding to my stepfather, that it was sort of a big deal in the news. In 1982, a national tabloid newspaper ran an unauthorized cover story on Rachel and her sister, claiming, "Oswald kids don't have dogs or dates." The word Oswald was stamped in red ink over photographs of the two girls. According to the story, Rachel was a miserable, lonely child. Her dogs had been poisoned. She had never been asked out on a date. She had no friends. Her family couldn't even afford to buy albums for her record player. In truth, Rachel was a healthy, active teenager. She studied gymnastics and ballet, made good grades, was a varsity cheerleader, and was even voted most popular student by her classmates. "Don't get me wrong," Rachel said, blushing a little. "I was shy, and I chose not to date much, but enough of the article was false that we filed a lawsuit and they settled out of court. I mean, things weren't completely normal. Sometimes when the cheerleading squad went to football games in different towns, people in the stands would shout stuff at me. You know, your daddy shot Kennedy. Or, good thing your daddy's dead and buried. But mostly things were pretty normal. The kids didn't care much one way or the other. It was usually the parents who did weird stuff. As Van Morrison's Moon Dance started up on the radio, Rachel danced her shoulders a little and then lit another cigarette. Dating was a little tricky, she said. There was always the question of whether I should tell the guy about Lee. If so, do I tell him on the first date or the third? What if I don't tell him at all? Believe it or not, a couple of guys at UT refused to ask me out again after I told them about my dad. One guy, I told, actually thought I was crazy. He got really scared and wanted to take me to a hospital. I guess it was easier for him to believe that I was insane than that Lee was my father. I've had assassination buffs send me roses and love letters. One guy tracked me down to the chili parlor and for a while was coming in several nights a week. I've listened to customers talk about Lee and the shooting, especially after JFK came out, without them knowing who I was. I actually once had a customer refuse to tip me. He said, "I know who your father is." And then he just got up and shook his head and left. What it boils down to is that every time I meet someone, every person at a party, every customer I wait on, every classmate, every teacher, every would-be friend, I ask myself, do they know who I am? Are they looking at me that way because of me or because I'm the daughter of Lee Harvey Oswald? Over a final round of drinks, we started talking about the movie JFK. I asked her what she thought of Gary Oldman's portrayal of her father. The question brought her up from her Bloody Mary. "The first time I met Gary," she said, "I was visiting my mother in Dallas. She told me that there was going to be a movie made about the assassination and asked if I wanted to have lunch that afternoon with Oliver Stone and Kevin Costner. My mother didn't even know who they were. And I was thinking to myself, oh my gosh, I'm going to have lunch with Oliver Stone and Kevin Costner. So we meet them at a Chinese restaurant. It was so exciting, you know, me being a young woman and everything. At the time, I didn't know Gary was involved in the movie. In fact, I didn't really even know who he was. But when he walked into the restaurant, he had come straight from rehearsal and seemed really tired. They were doing the scene where Lee was held in jail. And he was wearing the same white t-shirt and blue overshirt that Lee had been wearing. His hair was cut like Lee's, and the way he walked, he looked exactly like him. Then he sat down. I got really embarrassed, but every time I looked up, we would catch each other's eye. I think he was checking me out because I looked very much like my father, and I think he was trying to get a feel for my dad by looking at me. And then at one point, while he's asking my mother questions about Lee, he starts to cry. He said that he had been in jail for hours doing this scene, that he had been in handcuffs since dawn, that he had been beaten up and spit at, and that he had come to really empathize with what had happened to my father, and that now, looking at his wife and daughter, it really broke his heart to know what we had all gone through. We were terribly moved by this. As far as his portrayal in the movie, let me tell you, Gary Oldman is an actor. I remember my sister and I going to his hotel room and seeing 12 books about my father on the nightstand. Apparently, he had even gone to my father's grave. I mean, I've never gone to my father's grave. Is the movie accurate then? Everything about my father is accurate. So what do you think really happened? Do you think your father pulled the trigger? Rachel was quiet for a moment. I think that Lee was this 24-year-old guy, this youngster who got himself in over his head. Lee was intelligent, but he was no genius. I don't know who else was involved, but clearly it was too big of a deal for one 24-year-old kid to do by himself. For example, right before the shooting, someone asked my mother to take a picture of Lee holding a rifle, and then right after the shooting, the picture is confiscated, and everyone says, "Look, there's the gun. There's the guy who did it. Case closed." And apparently, there were police recordings of someone saying Jack Ruby was planning to kill Lee. And sure enough, the next day, Jack Ruby makes his way through all of the police and kills Lee live on national TV. I mean, think about it. There are just too many loose ends for it all to be dumped on my father. It was just too big of a deal. Until I was 23, I didn't even know there were alternative theories. I've only read a couple of books about it. I'm sorry for my father's pain, but basically, I just want it to be over, one way or another, especially by the time I have kids. It's hard having things written about you that aren't true. For example, this TV movie about my family. When I read the script, I was really angry. It's set in 1978, when I was 15 and my sister was 17. The writers portray me as this traumatized, victimized kid. There's a scene of me having a birthday party that no one comes to. Just me in my birthday hat, all by myself. That never happened. In the final scene, they have my sister and me walking hand in hand to the Kennedy Memorial, singing, "We Shall Overcome." That never happened either. I've never ever been to the Kennedy Memorial. The writers never talked to me or my sister about our lives. I guess they decided we must be a certain way and they wrote it. That kind of stuff makes you feel violated. I've tried not to make a big deal about things. I've never tried to profit from any of this. I've waited tables for the last 6 years, making maybe 40 or 50 bucks a night, to pay my way through college and nursing school. I have a bachelor's degree in natural sciences. I drive a beat-up car. I'm just a regular person. But there are still people who refuse to believe that I could be normal. That's what I hope my kids will never have to go through. Do you have any pictures of you and your father? No. All of our family pictures were confiscated. The bartenders were closing up, and Rachel said she needed to call it a night. There was more I wanted to ask, but it was clear from her face that she was wondering if she hadn't shared too much already. Looking at her, I was struck again by the peculiarity of the moment. I was sitting next to the daughter of a presidential assassin, an attractive and healthy woman who apparently wanted nothing more from life than to be a good nurse. Rachel went on to graduate from nursing school and find a job in the field. If it is true that poetry is the silence between words, then there is something genuinely poetic about the life Rachel Oswald is quietly leading between the headlines. A Ride for Mrs. Oswald. On November 22, 1963, I was a police reporter for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. I worked the late shift, but I rushed to the office as soon as I heard that President Kennedy had been shot, and I started answering the phones. The first call I took was from the mother of the alleged assassin. She asked me for a lift to Dallas. Guess what I said? By Bob Schieffer. Published January 2003. In 1963, I was the night police reporter at the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, the newspaper in the town where I grew up. I was 26 years old, made $115 a week, and worked the late shift, 6 o'clock in the evening to 2:30 in the morning. I hung out with cops, emergency room nurses, barmaids, and other creatures of the night. Like most young reporters who covered crime, I considered myself a superb investigator, more cop than journalist. I wore a snap-brim hat, hoping I'd be mistaken for a detective. And when someone made that mistake, I never corrected them. The stories I covered were an endless series of car wrecks and murders. The hours were awful, and the pay was low, even by Texas newspaper standards. I thought it was about the best job anyone could ever have. But when I heard that President Kennedy was coming to Fort Worth, I wasn't entirely happy about it. In those days, presidents didn't travel nearly as much as they do now, so it was big news for my hometown, but bad news for me. The political reporters would handle Kennedy, and they would not need any help from me. For a reporter, there's nothing worse than being in the middle of a big story that someone else is covering. I was more than a little irritated. Kennedy and his entourage flew into Fort Worth late on a Thursday evening. And, assignment or no, we had to put the paper to bed early Friday morning. I hustled over to the press club, which was open late to accommodate the traveling White House press corps. The party was well underway when I got there, around 2 in the morning, and for me, this was as good as it got. There I was, chatting up reporters I had known only by other byline. Miriam Smith of United Press International, Tom Wicker of the New York Times, and a dozen more. Kennedy had come to Texas to mend some fences in the Democratic Party and to raise money for the 1964 campaign. After a speech in Houston, he had flown to Fort Worth to spend the night and attend a Chamber of Commerce breakfast before taking a 10-minute flight to Dallas for a parade and a luncheon speech. The tour was going to end with a huge fundraising dinner in Austin. Governor John Connally had convinced Kennedy that only in Austin, the state capital, could you get people from the rest of the state to come to a fundraiser. People from Houston wouldn't go to San Antonio for a fundraiser, Connally told Kennedy, and people from Fort Worth damn sure wouldn't go to Dallas. He was right about that. When Amon Carter was running the Star-Telegram, he made a point of taking a sack lunch when he had business in Dallas, claiming he did not care for the city's restaurants. Dallas repaid the courtesy when Fort Worth renamed an airport between the two cities Amon G. Carter Field. Dallas residents declined to use the airport, in large part because of the name, and it eventually failed. The visiting reporters at the press club had no interest in our airports, of course. What they wanted to know about was a local after-hours joint called The Cellar. The Cellar had no liquor license, but if you were a friend of the owner, a former stock car racer named Pat Kirkwood, the drink of your choice, grapefruit juice spiked with grain alcohol, was on the house. It was not the drinks, however, but the fact that The Cellar's waitresses wore only underwear that had given the place some notoriety. And the notoriety had apparently spread as far as Washington. Phil Record, the Star-Telegram's Night City editor, and I were appointed to guide our visitors there. It must have been quite an evening. I remember that we stayed long enough for some of the Easterners to see their first Fort Worth sunrise. A group of off-duty Secret Service agents had joined us, and in months to come, there would be congressional hearings into whether the experience had left them as alert as they should have been in Dallas. Having no assignment that day, I could afford to sleep late, which was my normal practice. My father had died when I was in college, so I still lived at my mother's house, helping her make a home for my brother Tom and my sister Sharon. Tom had been 10 when Dad died, and Sharon 15. But by the time Kennedy came to Texas, Tom was in high school. And it was he who shook me awake, shouting, "Kennedy has been shot. You'd better go to work." Tom had been allowed to miss school that day, and he and mother had driven into town early to see the president as he emerged from the breakfast. As Kennedy walked out of the Hotel Texas and toward his car, Tom was one of the last people in Fort Worth to shake his hand. I dressed as quickly as I could, grabbed my black felt hat, and roared off in my triumph. As I parked in the lot near the Star Telegram office, the radio confirmed the worst. The president was dead. It was as if someone had hit me with a hammer. At once, I was stunned, hurt, and embarrassed. Stunned because such violence was unthinkable in those days. Hurt and embarrassed because it had happened in my home state. Why did something like this have to happen? And why did it have to happen in Texas? As I made my way inside the Star Telegram building, lines of people, two and three across, were already surrounding it. The Kennedy assassination would be the first story that the entire nation would watch together on television, and because of it, television would soon replace newspapers as the way most Americans got their news. But when Kennedy was shot, people still really didn't believe the news unless they saw it written down in black and white. So hundreds waited outside the Star Telegram for the special editions that rolled off the presses. The truth was, we couldn't print them fast enough, one of our editors said later. People would stand in line to buy one edition, then go to the back of the line to buy a copy of the next one. Inside the city room, it was bedlam. When the flash that Kennedy had been shot had hit the wires, an editor had dispatched so many reporters to Dallas that there was no one left on the city desk to answer the phones, and they were all ringing. Nonetheless, one of the editors told me to get to the police station. A man carrying a load of dynamite in his car had been arrested leaving Dallas County and was being taken to the Fort Worth jail. He was the best suspect so far in the Kennedy shooting. I managed to get to the station just as he was being brought down the back stairs. Early in my police reporting days, I learned a trick from the cops. People will sometimes blurt out the truth if they are surprised by a question. So I jumped in front of the handcuffed suspect, who was between two detectives, and shouted, "You son of a bitch, why did you do it?" "Well, I didn't," he said, as the cops hustled him into the lockup. In a matter of hours, it would become clear that the poor man had done nothing and knew no more about the assassination than the rest of us. He had stopped for gas at a service station between Dallas and Fort Worth and mentioned to the attendant what he had heard on the radio, that the president had been shot. The attendant hadn't heard about it and called the cops, figuring that the only person who could have known about the shooting was the one who had done it. When the police stopped the man's car and found the trunk loaded with dynamite, it was enough for them too. As the afternoon wore on, it was determined that the man was exactly who he said he was, a demolition contractor en route to a construction job. Had the incident happened today, it would have triggered lawsuits against the city and the police and at least the threat of one against me. But the police apologized and the man went on his way. When I got back to the city room, the confusion was even worse. By now, a dozen Star Telegram reporters were on the scene in Dallas, but when they called in, there was no one on the city desk to take down their stories. I hadn't even removed my hat when I settled behind a typewriter and picked up one of the phones. A woman's voice asked if we could spare anyone to give her a ride to Dallas. "Lady," I said, "this is not a taxi service. And besides, the president has been shot." "I know," she said. "They think my son is the one who shot him." It was the mother of Lee Harvey Oswald, and she had heard on the radio that her son had been arrested. "Where do you live?" I blurted out. "I'll be right over to get you." Why Marguerite Oswald called the Star Telegram that day remains a mystery, though she had a few connections to the paper. She had lived a vagabond life during most of Oswald's childhood, but she had eventually settled in Fort Worth, and when her son defected to the Soviet Union, Star Telegram reporters had interviewed her. As recently as 2 weeks before the assassination, she had been working as a governess in the home of Star Telegram founder Amon Carter's son. The Carters, who had no idea she was the mother of a defector, had discharged her because their children thought she was mean. I knew none of that as I began to think about how I was going to get her to Dallas. Somehow, taking her there in a convertible sports car just didn't seem quite right. So I went to Bill Foster, the paper's automotive editor. For years, local car dealers had furnished the auto editor with a new car every week or so and free gas. It was offered and accepted with the understanding that the editor would road test the car and write up the results in his Sunday column. When Bill told me he was driving a Cadillac sedan that week, I said, "Come on, I'll explain as we go and you're gonna like it." We found Mrs. Oswald standing on the lawn of a small home on Fort Worth's west side. She was a short, round-faced woman wearing enormous black horned rim glasses and a white nurse's uniform. She carried a small blue travel bag. I got into the back seat with her, and Bill drove. She was distraught, but in an odd way. I would later come to believe that she was deranged, but for most of the trip, she seemed less concerned with the death of the president or her role's son in it than with herself. She railed that his Russian-born wife would get sympathy while no one would remember the mother, and that she would probably starve. I chalked it up to understandable emotional overload, and I couldn't bring myself to use her self-serving remarks in the story I filed later that day. I probably should have. She would later be so brazen as to tell a reporter for Life magazine, "Mama wants money," a plea she repeated over the years. As she had predicted, the world showed her little sympathy, and she supported herself in the end by selling Oswald's clothing to souvenir hunters. The drive to Dallas took about an hour, and when we reached the police station, Bill let us out and said he would join us after he had parked the car. Hundreds of reporters had converged on the station, most of them in a hallway where the detective's offices were located. Wearing the Dick Tracy hat, it was easy for me to pass for a plainclothesman. There was a uniformed cop behind a counter in one of the offices, so I approached him and said, "I'm the one who brought Oswald's mother over from Fort Worth. Is there some place she can stay where she won't be bothered by all these reporters?" The officer guided us to a small space that seemed to be some kind of interrogation room and said, "How about this?" I thanked him, settled Mrs. Oswald in, and went into the hallway to see if I could help our guys. By then, there were 17 of us on the scene, but the problem was finding phones to call in what we had found out. Other reporters were having to walk several blocks. I began to gather up what our team had collected and call it in from the room the police had given me. Never once did anyone ask who I was. Later, Oswald's wife, Marina, was brought to the police station, and an officer asked me if we would mind her sharing the room. I told her I saw no problem. The only difficult for me was that she seemed to speak no English, only Russian. Around sundown, Oswald's mother asked Detective Captain Will Fritz if we could visit her son. Fritz agreed and led us into a holding room below the jail. The group included Oswald's wife, his mother, an FBI agent, and me. I couldn't believe it. Oswald was being brought down from his cell. Whatever he said, this would be the story of a lifetime. An exclusive interview with the man who had just been charged with killing the president. We had only been there a few minutes when the FBI agent casually asked me, "And who are you with?" I had watched veteran interrogators bluff their way with a suspect by answering a question with a question. And in my best imitation, I sort of half snarled, "Well, who are you with?" The agent seemed a little edgy now. "Are you a reporter?" Now I was really pushing it. "Well, aren't you?" It was at that point that I believe I received my first official death threat. The embarrassed agent said he would kill me if he ever saw me again. Or at least that seemed to be what he was saying. I was already leaving as he had said it. It was the biggest story I almost got. I went back to the corridor and blended in with the other reporters. For the next 2 days, I would just be part of the crowd. I spent the following day at the crime scene. The nation was in shock, and nowhere was it more obvious than in Dealey Plaza, where Kennedy had been shot. Hundreds of people seemed to wander aimlessly, occasionally talking to anyone who happened by. Some left flowers. Some just stared. I talked to one man who had come to Dallas to see Kennedy, but had only seen the motorcade racing toward Parkland Hospital. It was as if he had lost a friend. He could not understand how it could have happened. His grief became the heart of a story I filed for the Sunday paper, a story that began, "Today, I walked with a man named Gregory Ponce, and for a moment, he seemed to speak for all America." I've written thousands of stories since that day, but I've never forgotten the lead to that one. Oswald was still being held at the police station, but was to be transferred to the county jail the next day to await trial. We began to scale back our coverage. Our photographers were sent home. One of our reporters would watch Oswald as he was brought out of the city jail and placed in a car for the trip to the county jail nearby. I was to watch him arrive there. It was a trip he would never make. As two detectives brought him to the loading dock on Sunday morning, Jack Ruby walked from the crowd of reporters and onlookers, stuck a small pistol in Oswald's side, and killed him. How could it happen? I have been asked that question many times, and when I explain that it was a different time, the answer seldom seems to suffice. But those were the days before metal detectors, identification cards, and concrete barriers, all the security precautions that we have come to accept as a part of modern life, particularly since 9/11. We didn't shoot our presidents. We didn't know much about terrorists. And the only people who used bombs were gangsters. As long as they confined their killings to one another, we didn't really mind. In those days, if you looked as if you belonged, you could usually get in most places. I had walked into the Dallas police station and secured the use of an office on the strength of nothing more than a hat that made me look like a detective. Ruby had been a hanger-on at the police station. Because he had looked as if he belonged there, no one had questioned his presence. For the reporters, Oswald's shooting meant it was time to go back to work. Our managing editor, Lauren McMullen, decided to put out a Sunday afternoon extra, something that had never been done before. This was no simple task. When the paper had churned out those extras the day Kennedy was shot, the presses were already rolling with a complete newspaper that only needed to be updated. McMullen was talking about starting from scratch, a complete newspaper, including want ads, that would be on the streets early Sunday afternoon. Somehow, he managed to do it. We were so proud of the accomplishment that when the first copies were trucked over from Fort Worth, I grabbed a bundle and sold them myself at Dealey Plaza. I guess I still owe the paper some money. I don't remember turning in my profits, but in truth, I gave away more papers than I sold. It was a sweet scoop. Not only had we managed to get our papers to Dallas hours before the Dallas Morning News had printed its first edition of the Monday paper, but McMullen had also found a way around having no photo of the shooting. The Dallas paper had a graphic shot of Ruby just as he rammed the gun into Oswald's stomach and had moved it as a copyrighted photo on the Associated Press wire shortly after the event. McMullen grabbed it off the wire, blew it up, and spread it across the front page. Beneath the photo, in the tiny type used in baseball box scores, was the line, "Copyright 1963, Dallas Morning News." We had beaten the morning news with its own photo. In the days that followed, I realized the toll that long weekend had taken on me. I have heard of people who experienced traumatic events that left them so drained they were unable to feel pain. But for me, the overpowering shock of trying to work during the chaos surrounding the assassination left me so exhausted mentally that for a while, I somehow became immune to emotion. Several nights later, back on the police beat, I was in the emergency room of St. Joseph Hospital when the bodies of a family that had been fatally injured in a car wreck were wheeled by on gurneys. They had been beheaded when their car slammed into the rear of a truck loaded with metal pipes. a police reporter sees a lot, and injury and death were nothing new to me. But only after I had watched the bodies pass by did I realize that the sight had provoked no reaction at all. JFK's assassination only grows more distant at Dallas's Sixth Floor Museum. 30 years after opening, the museum approaches its dark history from an increasingly detached remove. By Sean O'Neill, published November 2019. The three men position themselves along the edge of Dealey Plaza, glancing up Elm Street, trying to time the traffic. This isn't easy. Elm slopes downhill, while local drivers know what to expect as they pass through the intersection at Houston Street, their cars nevertheless tend to accelerate as they approach the triple underpass near the western edge of downtown Dallas. Finally, there is a lull in the traffic, and the men sprint into the street, moving as briskly as their stiff-looking boots will allow, with their hands reflexively holding on to the brims of their Stetsons. One of them breaks off from the pack, readying his phone. The other two plant themselves on the large X that has been crudely affixed to the middle lane with reflective tape. There's some debate about its accuracy. The X moves a little whenever the road is repaved, replaced each time by still mysterious sources. But it supposedly marks the precise spot where President John F. Kennedy was hit by a fatal headshot on a sunny November day, much like this one. With the faded red brick building of the former Texas School Book Depository stationed picturesquely behind them, the two men position their feet on either side of the X and throw their arms around each other's shoulders. As their friend snaps away, they smile. It's a grim yet familiar scene, one that plays out many times per day here, like Dallas's own morbid version of Abbey Road. Like Abbey Road, you can even watch the spot via a live streaming webcam stashed inside the so-called sniper's perch on the old depository's sixth floor, from which Lee Harvey Oswald fired on Kennedy's motorcade as it passed by on the street below. It remains preserved behind a thick pane of plexiglass as the centerpiece of the sixth floor museum, where people have been coming since 1989 to revisit one of the darkest days in American history, November 22, 1963. A 15-minute documentary commemorating the museum's 30th anniversary plays on a loop near the exit. There is a slight air of defensiveness to the celebration, which is understandable. As museum curator Stephen Fagan explains in the video, a lot of people once regarded this blockish, unremarkable building at 411 Elm Street as the looming manifestation of evil. When the Texas School Book Depository Company finally moved out in 1970, there were numerous calls to raze it to the ground, some of them led by prominent Dallasites like Tom Landry, Mary Kay Ash, and Ross Perot. Instead, its owner, oilman D. Harold Byrd, sold it to country music producer Aubrey Mayhew, an opportunistic Kennedy collector, who hoped to turn it into a shrine to the late president. When the bank foreclosed on the building in 1972, Byrd bought it back via an auction in which he was the only bidder. An arsonist set fire to the building that same year. It stood empty once more until 1977, when it was purchased by Dallas County and converted into administrative offices. In 1984, as plans for a museum were once more ramping up, an arsonist struck again. There were many, it seemed, who simply wished it would disappear. Yet even as the former depository became a symbolic flashpoint for Dallas's anger and shame, visitors from all over the world continued to pilgrimage to Dealey Plaza. Some brought flowers and photos. Others simply came to gawk. Their persistence and curiosity convinced the museum's champions, chiefly Dallas County Public Works Director Judson Shook, preservationist Linda Lynn Adams, and historian Conover Hunt to spend more than 12 years fighting to save the building, convinced that the city had a responsibility to turn it into something that could confront the tragedy honestly and tastefully. Besides, as Shook remarks in the film, tearing it down would only confirm suspicions that Dallas had something to hide. It's been 3 decades since the Sixth Floor Museum opened, a longer time span than the one separating its birth from the tragedy it memorializes. Today, little controversy remains. Dallas has moved on, if not exactly embracing its role, then learning to roll with it. In 2013, Dealey Plaza hosted an official ceremony to mark the 50th anniversary of JFK's assassination. Whatever repressed feelings still lingered were surely exercised then, if not way back in 1991 when Oliver Stone commandeered downtown to film JFK, restoring Dealey Plaza to its 1963 vintage so he could kill the president over and over again. In the words of late Councilman Al Lipscomb, allowing Stone to drag those ghosts back out into the street was a good therapeutic enema, a purge to make sure there will be no residue of the past. What was left behind is largely what the museum's founders envisioned, a dignified, borderline clinical examination of the life and murder of John F. Kennedy, inside the very walls where the latter was carried out. Opinions about exactly what happened vary. Out in the plaza, you can still find plenty of card tables laden with literature that will tell you a story very different than the Warren Commission's. The sixth floor is a hushed and somber space, partly due to the fact that practically every visitor is plugged into a headset, listening as former WFAA reporter and assassination witness Pierce Allman guides them along walls of photographs and large text-filled placards. Video displays and newspaper reproductions give a sense of the turmoil that colored his trip to Texas, before a snaking path of stills from the infamous Zapruder film kick off a near millisecond-by-millisecond breakdown of the assassination and its aftermath. These are rendered safe for family viewing. No fatal headshots here. And the facts of the subsequent investigation are delivered cleanly and succinctly. The lingering questions of conspiracy are handled with similar detachment. Theories of CIA and mafia involvement laid out matter-of-factly on a pair of murals near the exhibit's end, finally concluding with a shrug, only that the discussion continues. There's little in the way of actual artifacts here. Anything of genuine interest was locked away inside the National Archives long ago. You will find Jack Ruby's gray fedora right next to the tan suit, cowboy hat, and handcuffs that belonged to the late Jim LaVille, the detective who was escorting Oswald on the day Ruby shot him. Around the corner is the camera that the Dallas Times Herald's Bob Jackson used to capture Oswald's murder for his Pulitzer-winning photograph. Nearby is another row of cameras, acquired from various Dealey Plaza eyewitnesses, each paired with the pictures they took. But undoubtedly, the most famous camera of all, Abraham Zapruder's, is represented by a copy. There's something surreal about this, as is the fact that one of the museum's main attractions is the large-scale model of Dealey Plaza that was used by the Warren Commission, a replica of the very place you're standing in. Even the sniper's perch is a recreation. The space it occupies is real, as are the scuffs visible on the original floorboards. But both it and the corner staircase where the now infamous Mannlicher Carcano rifle was discovered are staged, with cardboard boxes standing in for the ones that were taken away decades ago by the FBI. The infamous window, where Oswald is said to have fired that rifle, is just a facsimile, the original having been carved from the wall at some point during the building's long dormancy. Whether it was by Byrd or Mayhew remains a hot topic of debate and occasionally contested auction. Its neighboring windows overlooking the plaza have all been fitted with interactive touchscreens on which CGI models of the motorcade amble down Elm Street in an endless loop. Kennedy et al., reduced to pleasantly featureless avatars. On the headset, Allman explains that these things have been painstakingly arranged so that visitors can make a powerful connection with this building and its history. But doing so requires breaking through several layers of artifice. In many ways, the museum suits a man who is shrouded in myth in life, and in death even more so. What Norman Mailer once characterized as the elusive detachment of a man who was not quite real to himself, an aloofness that allowed Kennedy to capture the secret imagination of a people, gave way to the fairy tale mystique of Camelot, nurtured by the young president's shrewd manipulation of television. His assassination was TV as well. The flood of information and images across those 3 days in November, blurring the lines between news and narrative, and creating a gulf of understanding that quickly calcified into mistrust. That suspicion has since echoed across hundreds of books, films, Broadway musicals, and internet rabbit holes. The ambient paranoia it created is woven into the fabric of American life. I'm as guilty as anyone of buying into this mythos. I was a JFK assassination buff from an early age, a fascination that began with a sixth grade report on the Warren Commission. My mother, a former Fort Worth Star-Telegram reporter, was friendly with the late Jim Mars, whose 1989 book, Crossfire, The Plot That Killed Kennedy, became a partial basis for Oliver Stone's film. She took me to one of Mars's presentations, an abridged version of the conspiracy theories he had been lecturing on at the University of Texas at Arlington since 1970, and I was hooked instantly. I had her take me to JFK on opening night. Alas, I couldn't convince her to let me skip school so we could watch Stone film the motorcade. I spent much of my adolescence thereafter carrying around books like Best Evidence and On the Trail of the Assassins, becoming intimately familiar with assassination characters like Umbrella Man and Babushka Lady. Were it not for my discovery of punk rock, I might have grown up to be the obsessive nerd in Richard Linklater's Slacker, still haranguing casual acquaintances about Lee Harvey Oswald's Breakfast. Looking back now, it's easy to see how closely my dark enthusiasms dovetailed with the timeless teenage rite of passage of deciding that everything is bullshit. In signing my copy of Crossfire, Mars wrote, "Always question authority." Probably a stock line for him, though it felt to me like a mandate handed down from one subversive to another. Of course, the fact that Dealey Plaza was so close to my hometown of Arlington played a major role in fostering my ghoulish pastime. On our way back from a Dallas Sidekicks game at Reunion Arena, I always got a perverse thrill passing by the old depository building, instinctively glancing up to that permanently half-open window, then quickly over to the grassy knoll, as though the mystery would reveal itself to me if I only looked hard or often enough. Again, the place had ceased to be real to me, transformed through Stone's intoxicating panache and the X-Files folklore into something more akin to a movie set. Even revisiting the museum today, as my GPS instructs me to turn from Houston onto Elm, my brain still fills in the rest with bits of Kevin Costner's climactic courtroom monologue in JFK. It's gonna be a turkey shoot. Returning to the museum now, I intended to reckon with the fact that I once treated a man's gruesome death as something like a hobby, and Dealey Plaza like my own personal Universal Studios. But I found that whatever connection I hoped to make, or profound truth I thought I might discover, only seemed further obfuscated, not just by time, but intent. With its CGI recreations and webcam, the virtual reality aspect of it all felt even more pronounced. At the Museum Cafe across the street, I found tourists eating ice cream cones beneath a slideshow of Oswald's arrest. In the attached gift shop, you can get a signed print of Jackson's infamous photo of Ruby shooting Oswald for $250, one of the pricier items from a bounty of merchandise that includes Texas school book depository-shaped keychains and refrigerator magnets. Here, as it has everywhere, the JFK assassination has grown as an industry. Even the conspiracy theories have become something of a lifestyle, evidenced in the messages from QAnon believers I find scrawled in the museum's memory books. The sixth floor isn't to blame for this, of course, any more than the city of Dallas is for Kennedy's death. It has made the best of its unthinkable situation, responding with an admirably positive attempt to educate rather than titillate. On the day I visit, the museum is packed with people of all ages and nationalities, high schoolers on field trips, European tourists, a couple of zombified parents pushing strollers. They continue to be drawn here to learn not only about Kennedy's death, but his legacy. And in those same guest books, next to the jokesters who have scribbled, "The Mob Did It," you'll find earnest testimonials in looping cursive from kids who seem to have just now discovered Kennedy's role in the space race and the civil rights movement. In this, the museum has clearly succeeded in its goal of crafting a memorial to the man, not his murderer. That said, it's jarring to see just how much separation it's created from the very space it occupies, a distance that has only grown since 1989. Visiting there again after so many years away, I find myself wondering how it and I, once upon a time, might have benefited from it remaining dusty and abandoned, allowing you to confront just how scarily ordinary it must have been for Oswald, or some other mortal, to fire a gun out of those windows and topple a kingdom. Maybe whatever the site lost in dark appeal, it might have gained in cathartic truth. But perhaps we can only comprehend the mythos this way, through layers of plexiglass and X's in the street. It's truly history now, with all the comfort the distance of time allows. Just before I head for the exit, I watch a man posing by that sealed-off corner staircase, positioning himself just so, next to the replica of the rifle believed to have altered America forever. As his wife readies the camera,
next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Senior Notes, followed by the History Book Hour at 9.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 68 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the upper 50s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the upper 70s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the mid-50s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 8 p.m.
It's make-believe ballroom time. Put all your cares away. All the bands are here to bring good cheer your way. It's make-believe ballroom time, and free to everyone. It's no time to fret, your dial is set for fun. Just close your eyes and visualize in your solitude. Your favorite bands are on the stands, and Mr. Miller puts you in the mood. It's make-believe ballroom time, the hour of sweet romance. Here's your make-believe ballroom. Come on, children, let's dance, let's dance.
Hi, folks, I'm Jeff Bressler, turning on the lights of the make-believe ballroom and welcoming you into my crystal studio for another program of the great hits of the 1930s and 1940s. I'm hosting the show to keep the music and traditions of past hosts, Martin Block, Al Jarvis, William B. Williams, and the legendary Steve Allen alive. Whether you're one of my longtime listeners or a new listener on public broadcasting or community radio stations across the U.S. as well as in the U.K., grab your dance ticket, it's free, and let's reminisce. Hello world and welcome to the ballroom, and thank you for joining me this hour as we listen to some wonderful swing, jazz, and big band music, as well as many of the stories behind the records I play. In just a moment, how two iconic big band leaders got their regal names. But first, I haven't played any Charlie Barnett in some time, so I'm going to open the ballroom this week with Barnett and his Knocking at the Famous Door, recorded on the Bluebird label in 1939, direct from my Victrola turntable on the console here in the Crystal Studio. Nicknames. First, let's talk about Edward Kennedy Ellington. Edward was given the nickname of Duke early in life, and it was said he became Duke due to his suave nature and classy manners. But here's a historic fact you may not know about another nickname he had, which